Newstime 8:14. Good morning. Well, during a special legislative session on Monday, lawmakers approved sweeping changes to the medical marijuana legislation that was approved by voters on Election Day. On the phone to discuss the legal options being considered, I have the former mayor of Salt Lake City and attorney Rocky Anderson. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So this is, of course, a statewide issue. We try to focus on the local, but Summit County voters, I think, had the largest percentage voting in favor of Prop 2. So I'm guessing it's something I think our listeners are interested in. There has been talk that a lawsuit is imminent after the legislature's action on Monday. How come?
Because the legislature has disregarded what the people said they wanted and voted for in the initiative, Prop 2. There is quite an unusual, in fact, we're the second state in the country to adopt an initiative and referendum provision in our Constitution that allows the people to legislate and to, after all of the work that's gone into the initiative and the majority vote for the Proposition 2, for the legislature at the earliest possible time after the effective date of that proposition to completely wipe out so many of the provisions for meaningful access for medical cannabis is not only incredibly anti-democratic, but really contemptuous of the people who have spoken here. It's no wonder that so few initiatives are attempted in Utah, because it seems that whenever they're passed, the legislature is ready to repeal them or modify them in very material and negative respects. And here, it clearly was driven by the LDS Church, which is a major opponent of Proposition 2, and what people are calling a compromise was really a total capitulation to the opponents of Proposition 2.
And let's get to some of those biggest complaints, but back to the reach of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I mean, lots of comments on social media. I think the biggest one being that if the church wants to help create legislation, then they should have to pay taxes like the rest of us. Is the church's involvement in the rewriting of this legislation part of any lawsuit?
There is a claim where we won't be pursuing anything immediately on it, but it will be in our complaint that they have exercised the kind of control and interference with functions of state government that are absolutely prohibited by our Constitution. We have a very unusual establishment clause in our Constitution. It's because of the theocracy in Utah prior to statehood. And they put in, I don't think it's in any other state's constitutions, that no church shall control the state or interfere in functions of government. And they do it all the time. We all know they do it all the time. I think that everybody tries to be really polite and dances around the issue, but there's no question. For instance, on alcohol laws, anybody will tell you there's not an alcohol law that will ever see the light of day in the Utah State Legislature. Won't even come up for a vote unless it has the imprimatur, the approval of the first presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They sent out emails to all their members. Marty Stevens, for instance, who's the point's lead man on this issue, got up. He's a state president, got up and told his congregation on the Sunday before the election, 2 days later, that everybody should vote against Proposition 2. I just think that we really all have had enough of this. Members and non-members alike really find a lot of resentment in the control exercised by this institution that on laws that apply to everybody in the state. And this is probably the most egregious example, because after the people let their will be known, according to the Constitution, and going through all of the onerous procedures set up for an initiative to get on the ballot, a majority voted for it, and then we hear this ultra-parochial response from legislators that, well, gee, the people in my district didn't vote for it. That's not how it works. the majority of voters statewide are to control in these matters. And we don't have an additional test that the majority of voters in each district, in each legislative district, vote for it. Once a majority have voted for it, that is the law. It ought to be protected. And what the legislature has done here and what they did with the forfeiture initiative several years ago and what they're likely to do with the Better Boundaries initiative is to simply substitute their will and their views for those of the people. And it's time that we stand up to them and say, we're going to fight against this. We're going to try to make certain that the courts require that the intention of the Constitution is honored by our legislature.
Now, my understanding is that you have served notice to sue, and I guess that's because it's a government agency, but who's the defendant in the case?
No, there wasn't a notice to sue. It was a notice that they're not to destroy any evidence, that they're to maintain their documents and the electronic communications because we were exploring a lawsuit. That it's what you call a non-spoliation letter, that you're not to get rid of any evidence. But we are preparing a lawsuit as soon as we can get that done. It's very complicated. This was a moving target. They kept changing the bill repeatedly. And in fact, as late as the Friday before the Monday special session, another version of it came out. It's now 200 pages long. It's a combination of Kafka and Alice in Wonderland. And the extent to which the LDS Church and the legislature have gone to deny people access to relief from suffering is truly shameful and, again, contemptuous of Utah voters.
So, again, the defendants would be the governor and all of the lawmakers who voted in favor of the bill as well as the church?
The defendants are likely going to be the head of the health department and the governor in their official capacities and asking the court to restrain them from giving effect to House Bill 3001 and putting back in place the initiative statute, which is Proposition 2. That's what the people voted for. And, I hear legislators make the point, well, we live in a representative democracy. Well, no, they haven't read our state's constitution because it was amended in 1900 to provide that legislative power is not just in the legislature, but also it resides in the people who have all of the political power. And that through the initiative process, they're to be able to pass laws through direct democracy. And it's time that the people stand up for that right and fight against this kind of emasculation of the right, total violation of that right by the Utah legislature.
Yep. Supporters of House Bill 3001 say this bill is the best-designed medical cannabis program in the country. And as we know, Prop 2 only passed by a small majority. I mean, I guess if this law had been offered to voters, perhaps we would have seen even more support for it or no?
That's so totally speculative. People like Speaker Hughes saying, well, they expected these compromises. There is zero basis for that. It might be anecdotal, but, there on any initiative, you could make that excuse for changing what the people passed. This Proposition 2 is what the people passed, and that should be given effect by our legislature. Legislature should not be free, for instance, to strip out all immune diseases as qualifying conditions, all immune diseases except for two, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. All other immune diseases they stripped out. And what do they say? They say that, oh, the Utah Medical Association wanted to shorten the list. There's no renter protection. Under Proposition 2, 18 to 21-year-olds were covered. Here, every person, 18 to 21, although they can be prescribed opioids by their doctors, if a doctor wants to recommend medical cannabis, every one of those people, 18 to 21, have to jump through these additional hoops going before a so-called compassionate use board for them to make the determination as to whether they get medical cannabis.
And Prop 2 also allowed for privately established dispensaries, and what is it that the legislation did?
Well, the legislature put in place something that almost makes the DABC look reasonable, and that will never look reasonable. They put in place a state bureaucracy that's going to delay relief for suffering. It's going to be very expensive. It's going to be very cumbersome, and it's going to make things much less reasonably accessible in terms of the number of dispensaries and where they're going to be located. So they now, instead of private market model as contemplated by Proposition 2, although it was highly regulated, it was a free market system. They put in a state, they call it central fill system, where all the orders for marijuana will be filled there and then distributed to a greatly reduced number of private dispensaries. And they provide for local health department offices to be a pickup place, but there's no guarantee that the health department's ever going to put that in place. And in fact, the bill contemplates that those offices very well may not be put into place, because the bill provides for contingencies, saying if they're not put in place, then there will be, after a period of time, two more private dispensaries allowed, and then after a period of time, perhaps one. So instead of 30-plus dispensaries provided for under Proposition 2, now they're providing for only 7 private dispensaries, which may be as many as 10, limiting it to 10. So this is all about vastly reducing access to medical cannabis, and it's all about exercising control, and I also think it's largely about saving face. One of the sponsors of Proposition 2 that now have gone over to the other side and worked out this compromise said in a meeting that it was about saving the church face. And this shouldn't be about the church saving face. They lost. They campaigned aggressively against Proposition 2. They ought to accept the loss. The legislature ought to accept what the people said and put in place the result of direct democracy through Proposition 2.
Yep.
And that was in effect for Saturday, Sunday, and part of Monday, and it's now been stripped away from the people, and we're going to challenge that.
Yeah. Back to the notion that this legislation reverses the plan for a free market system under Prop 2. I mean, I'm guessing, doesn't that then just create some more legal challenges for the state, given that, I think this would make Utah the only state in the country that would dispense drugs that on a federal level are still considered illegal.
You're absolutely right. That's a huge flaw. Another huge flaw is that it's still contrary to federal law to dispense, and there are even some money laundering issues in terms of the use of banks and that sort of thing. The state needs to stay out of it. There are those, as in other states where laws provided for medical marijuana, where people are willing to set up private dispensaries and help doctors make relief from suffering available for their patients. I think there are huge risks being undertaken here. And one other thing that, in that regard, that this new bill provides that wasn't anywhere in Proposition 2 is, although they don't use the word prescription in the bill, they basically provide that everything that is entailed in a prescription be done by the qualified medical provider in determining what the routes of administration are and what means is to be used and what the amounts are. That is a prescription. And so the qualified medical provider is putting him or herself at risk under federal law by doing that. But there's a default under this in the statute, and that is if the medical provider doesn't make that detailed recommendation regarding the dosing regimen and all, then the pharmacist is to do it. Well, pharmacists aren't supposed to be practicing medicine. They're not supposed to be prescribing. They're not supposed to be determining doses and means of administration and all the rest of it. And so I don't know, if a pharmacist and a doctor came to me and said, can we do this under federal law, I think that I would have to warn them that they're facing very significant risks. And this all was avoided, and very carefully avoided, under Proposition 2. They looked at the case law, and there's federal case law saying that physicians can recommend marijuana, medical marijuana. And that now, instead of providing that safeguard, they're saying that the providers, the medical providers or the pharmacists, are to determine precisely how much, what kind of cannabis substances or products, and the means of administration. And so they've turned something that was very simple, was going to be very uncomplicated, inexpensive, yet highly controlled, into an enormous bureaucracy entailing all sorts of risks for everybody. And I might say that this affirmative defense is supposed to be provided for people between now and when all of this gets set up. The legislation is very convoluted, but once you work your way through it, you can see that it's going to be impossible for anybody to have unprocessed cannabis flower and find an affirmative defense, because the bill requires that it be in a blister pack and that it be barcoded. That's not going to happen. That's not going to be anywhere available during this affirmative defense period. So nobody can take any comfort that requires unprocessed cannabis flower. And there's good reason for using unprocessed cannabis flower. When it's unprocessed, when it's unheated, you don't get any high. Instead of THC, you're getting THCA, which is not an intoxicant. It doesn't make you high. It's only when it's processed or heated that it becomes THC. So, once again, what they say they're trying to do works absolutely counter to the interests of so many patients that really ought to have available to them cannabis products, including unprocessed flower, for the relief of their suffering from so many medical conditions.
Hey, Rocky, I need to wrap this up. So quickly, when do you expect to have a lawsuit filed?
Well, we've been shooting. We were hoping to get it yesterday or today, but it's very complicated and working through. And I mean, we're not only filing a complaint, we're going to be filing a motion for an injunction to take effect right away. And it's just a very complicated matter when you're going through a 200-page convoluted bill and comparing it with what was in Proposition 2. But there's no question. I mean, we've just touched here during this conversation on the many ways in which our legislature has adversely affected and really wiped out in so many ways the central purposes of Proposition 2 that the voters voted on.
Yeah.
And so certainly medical cannabis is a crucial issue, but the larger constitutional issue is whether the people are going to be able to maintain the initiative power of direct democracy, or whether in every instance the legislature can so arrogantly just wave it off and say, we know better, and replace their views for those of the people.
And who's your client? Who's paying the legal bills here?
Our client is, there are two nonprofit organizations that really don't have much, if any, money. It's Epilepsy Association of Utah, and its director, Doug Rice, who is a caretaker of his daughter, who badly requires cannabis products for control of her seizures. And then Christine Stenquist and the organization for which she's the executive director, Truce. And they, Doug and Christine, were both sponsors of Proposition 2. And Christine is probably, I think, most certainly alive today only because of her ability to use cannabis products.
Okay.
And that's the other thing, is if people aren't able to get them, this legislation is driving. It's going to drive people into the black market. There are going to be people who say, why should I go before a compassionate use board rather than just take a drive to Wendover or Colorado?
Okay. Need to leave it there. Rocky Anderson, appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you a lot.
It's 8:35. Good morning. Well, the Park City Council last week authorized the formation of a forest advisory board. In the studio with details about what this board does, Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning.
Good morning. And I have with me the planner from my shop who did most of the work on this, Liz Jackson. She's here to make sure I don't make any mistakes.
Okay.
But truthfully, we've been a Tree City USA from the U.S. Arbor Commission for the past 20 years, and you'll see the sign on our wall and all of that. And the forestry board is required to be in force, and we are required to spend a certain amount of money every year in order to maintain our reputation as Tree City USA. So this board's been around, it's been pretty quiet, and we reconstituted it differently to achieve some different goals, especially with respect to wildland fire and drought-tolerant landscaping.
So how many people are on this board?
Right now it's comprised of only professionals, and we'll talk about that in a second. It's the planning director, city engineer, sustainability manager, and the trails and open space manager, and the parks manager. And the person that's been mostly responsible for this is Maria Brandt, who's absolutely fabulous in taking care of the landscapes that the community has, everything from the baskets on Main Street to the really cool landscaping at the Mark. And so Maria's been doing all this thing. We wanted to give her some additional support on all of those.
Yeah. So in terms of what it does, I mean, other than that you have to have it to remain, you know, as a tree city, what is it going to do?
Well, it's professional at this point. And we did get some commentary from the council on why we did not have citizen representation on this. And there's a specific reason for that, and that is we did not want to task one or two people with the responsibility of responding to the public. We wanted to be able to reach out to the members of the public that we would influence on any one point of the time. So we believe we're being more diverse by not appointing representation. And so our most important tasks right now are to look at other communities and make sure that our drought-tolerant landscaping and our planting plans are appropriate and we have the right plant materials. Our second most important job is to raise the technical skills behind wildland fire and wildland fire interface. Our third job is to do what the sustainability department does and what Heinrich does in making sure that our open space is managed correctly, whether we put cows on it at the farm or we do fuels management at the airy. All those things will be reviewed and accomplished with the advisory board.
Yeah, so it's just an advisory board, so
yeah, yeah.
Just making recommendations.
Yep.
I mean, any idea of what new ordinances you would propose?
Actually, that's the work that Planner Jackson has already done. She put this ordinance together. We're going ahead with changes to the land management code in 2 weeks, which will adopt a plant materials list consistent with all the other resort towns that we deal with, so that inside of our city rights of way, our open space lands, we will have an approved plant list that works for drought tolerant and works for FireWise, also works for wildland fire interface. And two, we have the opportunity to make recommendations for people on private property to use this plant list. So if they use the plant list that Liz has put together, then it speeds through our approval process. If somebody wants to change it, then I have to make a recommendation.
Well, Councilmember Steve Joyce made a good point at last week's meeting. I mean, if the board's activities apply to future construction, that's fine, but town's virtually built out. I mean, what do we do retroactively about all of the existing landscaping in current homes?
One is education. Two is we can make these things retroactive if the government chooses to. So, for example, the building official reviews all of our commercial structures on an annual basis for fire protection. If we really, really want to do wildland fire protection in this community, we will do annual inspections. I have another planner that works for me that we got out of the San Diego department, and they inform us that California actually fines land owners and property owners if they don't remove standing dead trees on their property. And this is especially effective in Truckee and the Tahoe Basin and the fires you saw in California. We also know up in the Colony, which is a private HOA, that they require tree removal within 400 feet of their approved structures every single year. So that's several tens of thousands of dollars to the property owners. So depending on what the city council wants to do and how important wildland fire protection is to us, we will adjust.
Yeah, and certainly with the majority of homes within city limits, second homes, I mean, how do you reach out to those folks? I mean, they're here 2 weeks a year.
We can be really crabby. So the first step is, and we really appreciate cooperation of the fire district. The first step is we're getting together with the fire district, and we're going to have a little bit of a professional conference. And some of the resort town planners that have experience, our team that has experience, and the firefighters, make sure we're doing the right thing. Sun Valley's had two fires in the last 2 years, one that almost took out the hospital. We had the Brian Head fire 2 years ago, and the ones down in Spanish Fork this year. So we're trying to learn from that experience. And our sympathies go out to the folks in Paradise, California, because I have no idea what it takes to be the planning director of that community and rebuild that place.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell us about it?
Thank you. It's important. Folks can come and talk to me at the liquor store, at the No Name, or the grocery store, and I'll give them the information.
Okay. Bruce, thanks. Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Well, tonight, Park City resident and extreme athlete Rob Lee and his fiancée Caroline Gleick will present a slideshow of their ascent to Choyu, the sixth highest peak on Earth. It's part of an evening of video and photo presentations to support the Utah Avalanche Center. Rob and Caroline join me now in the studio. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nice to be here.
This mountain, what, 26,000 plus feet? And something I think that was on your bucket list, Caroline, to climb and ski?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a long time dream of climbing and skiing in the Himalayas, and Choyu is something we had talked about going to do for a couple of years, and this year we finally did it, pulled the trigger.
And Rob, this was your first attempt at mountain climbing, or you've been climbing?
No, I've done some other high mountains, including Denali and Aconcagua, the highest mountains in North and South America. So this was kind of on the list. Caroline, it was a mountain that she wanted to do, but it's also a great training mountain for Mount Everest. So
yeah,
that's where.
So that's something, Caroline, that you do, is that you hike and then ski. You climbed and then what? Repelled?
Nope. And then, on most of my mountains, I've obviously just walked down. On this mountain, I took my skis as well. I didn't ski as much as Caroline on this one. She definitely is a little more comfortable in some of those situations, and this is what she does for her career. But I got some turns in as well.
Great. So how many vertical feet was the ski?
I got to ski about 6,000 vertical feet. Yeah. So it was quite long. And at that altitude, you know, you take a turn, you catch your breath, take a turn, catch your breath. So it's pretty slow going. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's and the steepness of the grade? I mean,
definitely some steeper sections, some like 40 to 45 degree sections. And then there's some ice cliffs you have to rappel over and some rock cliffs too. So it's got a little bit of everything.
Yeah. And were avalanches a concern?
Yeah, they're, I mean, not so much on the route we climbed up, but it's sort of always a concern when you're on a mountain like that. And so I was going to ski a different route, but then when Rob decided not to ski, I decided to stay on the route that we ascended, stick closer to the group and the fixed lines.
Okay. So talk to me a little bit about the tonight's presentation. It sounds like you're one of several actually giving a presentation.
There's four presentations tonight. So we're going to talk about Choyu. And then Noah Howell, he is a local backcountry skier and ski mountaineer. And he kind of organizes this event. And so he's going to talk about his trip up to Alaska Mountain Hunter.
And Cody Hughes is a local split boarder, and he is going to talk about a trip to Norway. And then I'm not sure what Cindy Liu's presentation is about.
I think she's got a little bit of everything.
She's a great speaker, and yeah. I've presented with her before, and she is just, yeah, I'm sure whatever she talks about, it's going to be awesome.
Okay, it's a benefit for the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. It's the Jim Santee Auditorium, and I think it starts at 6:30.
6:30, should be about 2 hours. Tickets are $15. You can get those online, or you can just show up at the door tonight.
Okay. Meanwhile, Rob, it sounds like you've caught the climbing bug and so decided you're going to attempt Everest next year. Now, have you done Everest, Caroline?
I haven't climbed Everest, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to do it, but when we were on Choyu, we got a really good look at Everest, and the first thing I thought when I saw it was, I want to climb it and I want to ski it. So I'm going to go with him, and this will probably be a climbing trip, but maybe sometime I can go back and ski.
Okay. I had heard it's not cheap to get to Everest. How are you guys raising the money to do that?
That's what we're trying to figure out is obviously we got a lot of training to do. I still have my full-time job at Berkshire Hathaway selling real estate here in Park City. And then to try to figure out this fundraising part is a little difficult. But we're looking for sponsors, so we're kind of in the throes of reaching out to companies and whatnot. We're also going to set up a GoFundMe page if people just want to make some donations as well. And then, of course, it'll be a combination of those and our own money to try to make this happen.
Okay, so that would be like in the spring, April, May, is that?
Yeah, April 22nd is likely when we would meet everyone over there.
Wow. And then that's the first on the to-do list for 2019. Then you, Rob, plan to swim the English Channel. I mean, it's something, you're a good swimmer. You swam in high school.
Yep, I swam in high school and swam in college. Kind of in the triathlon scene for a long time, had some injuries, and then about 2 years ago, had some ankle injuries, and at that time, I kind of said, I need a new goal, and swimming came to mind. English Channel was the first thing that popped in my head, so I've been training to do that, and that will hopefully take place July 10th through the 16th. I've got a boat and a boat pilot, as they call them, to kind of navigate me across the English Channel there.
How far is it?
As the crow flies, it's about 21 miles, but with the tides, you definitely don't swim a straight line, so it ends up being about 25, 26, 27 miles.
Wow. So is that what the boat does? Kind of helps guide the right line for you?
Yeah, and it's the heavy shipping lane in the world as well, so they're just trying to keep you safe from all the boats and just make sure you're kind of heading in generally the right direction.
Okay, so wetsuit or no?
No wetsuit. That's probably the biggest crux for me. Not to say that that's not a long distance to swim, but I feel pretty good about that. My biggest thing is training for this cold water. So the water should be about 60 degrees, I'm hoping. If it's under that, it's going to be even more difficult. But to spend 10 to 15 hours, at least for me, to do this in 60 degree water without a wetsuit is going to be really the crux.
So, well, I don't know. Everest is pretty cold, but does the wetsuit then kind of disqualify you if you were to use one?
You know, I think some people probably use wetsuits, but you're just not recognized by the English Channel Swimming Association. It's just kind of taking away the essence of the swim and kind of how that it was originally done. And so this is how you do it. You have to do a whole qualification process to even get in the water. And then, you got to go without a wetsuit. You can never touch the boat or anything like that. Otherwise, you're immediately disqualified.
You have no body fat on you, Caroline, so you don't even do it. Don't even try.
What are you saying about me?
You have to feed him on a stick. Yeah, I've got a lot to learn as a person who would be crewing him for that. And so I feel like being the role of supporter there will be a big enough challenge for me, not getting seasick on the boat. So I might need to train for that.
Oh, okay. And so really, that's how you get fed?
They've got either like kind of a stick or just like throw a water bottle that's kind of attached to a string because I can never touch the boat. So they've got to kind of throw things to me and then tread water for a couple of seconds, get some liquid and some food down and then keep going.
Okay, so if that wasn't enough, you also decided you're going to ride your bike across America next year.
Well, so this all goes back to my triathlon days, and after I kind of decided I was going to try to do the English Channel and Everest, I figured I had to make a triathlon somehow. And I've always wanted to do all three of these things, so the first thing that came to mind was, of course, riding across America. So that'll be the goal to do in the fall, in like September.
Okay, and I'm guessing that nobody's even attempted to do
So when I first decided to do the English Channel, I started looking at it, and people call it the Everest of swimming. And I thought, I wonder if anybody's done both. And it turns out there's been a couple people who have done Everest and the English Channel, but never in the same year. And so that's kind of why I said, maybe I can try this in the same year. And then I thought, I'm a triathlete, so I got to throw a bike in there. So that's where the whole thing came together. So no one's ever done this whole thing together, especially not in a year.
Okay, so between, like I say, all of the training and just traveling that you'll be doing, you'll be working?
I'll be working, and on the top of Choyu, actually, we got up there, and Caroline actually dropped one knee and asked me to marry her. So now we got to plan a wedding, and we got a wedding next summer as well to throw into the mix.
Why not?
Right? Why not? Yeah.
Not enough to do. Well, congratulations on that. Again, you guys will be talking tonight at the Jim Santee Auditorium. Is there going to be a way to follow your adventures?
Yeah, probably the quickest and easiest way right now would be just my Instagram account. That's rob.lee. You can also follow me on Facebook. And then I'll have, I'm going to set up some accounts for this project as well. So if you go to rob.lee on Instagram, you'll be able to find those links.
Okay, and it's spelled L-E-A.
L-E-A, yes.
Okay, well, best of luck to you. Congratulations, and look forward to hearing more about it.
Thanks so much. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
It's, again, Rob Lee and Caroline Gleick. Well, as part of the Real Community Series, Park City Film presents the screening of Bias. Thursday night in the studio, I have the film's director, Robin Hauser, along with Park City Film director, Katie Wang. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Katie, we'll give you the start here just with the details of Thursday screening.
Yep. Sure. So we're presenting the film in partnership with the Women's Giving Fund, which, of course, is a project of the Park City Community Foundation. It'll be Thursday, tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. It's a free screening. We're really excited to have Robin back here in our community, and we really feel like this film taps into the local conversations about social equity and how we as a community can really start engaging in that conversation. So, of course, the Community Foundation is the perfect partner for that. The film will be followed by a panel discussion, which, of course, Robin will be on. So we're really excited she's here for that. We'll also have Dr. Marco Barker, who is Westminster's Associate VP for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Sadie Ortiz, who's a high school senior here, who's part of Latinos in Action and Teen Council. And then Megan Zarnetsky, who's the social justice teacher at Treasure Mountain, will be the moderator. So really engaging. We don't want to show you the film and leave you with your own thoughts. We want to really get you to dig into it and unpack all the great ideas that are in this film.
All right. Well, Robin, talk a little bit about the reasons for your film. It's called Bias.
It is. It's called Bias, and it's about unconscious bias that lives in all of us, right? If you have a brain, you have bias. I was fascinated by this subject. My last film, Code Debugging the Gender Gap, went really all around the world, and a lot of the discussion that stemmed from that film was about what is at the root of some of these isms that plague our society: racism, sexism, ageism. And I began to hear a lot of this term unconscious bias or implicit bias, and it fascinated me because it's something that we all have. It's a heuristic process, heuristic tendency, and yet how is that useful in the modern world, right? How does it either thwart us or help us move forward in both in the workplace and socially?
So it's we all have this. Some of us just, are very unaware of it?
Well, I actually think most of us are unaware of our biases. This is what's fascinating. Just like you can't do two math problems in your head at once, we actually don't have the ability to see bias in ourselves. So we might know that we're biased towards dogs because we were bit by one when we were 2 years old. But we don't know other biases that we hold inside us and how that really interacts with some of the choices that we make on a daily basis.
Yeah. As one person in the film says, we were wired to be suspicious of people different from us. It's proved to be very useful. I mean, does the film say it's not any longer? Or?
Well, exactly. So when we lived in tribes, our ancestors had to be suspicious of people that looked different than us, that had different cultures, that behaved differently. That's how we protected ourselves. But that's when we lived in really highly segregated societies. So now that we live in more cosmopolitan sort of society, how is that useful if we're suspicious of everybody that isn't exactly like us? And we all suffer from something called like me bias. Now, in some cases, that might be helpful, but in most cases, especially think about in hiring, like me bias can really steer you to hire the wrong person. Because if you hire people that are only just like you, you're building sort of this cocoon of yes. You're probably not having a diverse perspective, contributions from different perspectives that could really help you build a better company and create better products.
Hmm. So who do you talk to in the film?
Well, we talked to all sorts of people. It's experts, really. It's based on the implicit association test, which was designed by Tony Greenwald and Mazran Banaji. And the implicit association test measures our associations between two things. For example, between women and career versus men in career, or women in family versus men in career. And so this, I actually take the test and reveal some of my biases, some of which are very shameful, in the film. And that's really a basis to measure that we all have biases.
I was going to ask, so what did you learn about your own biases? What, that you're embarrassed by them, or how?
Yeah.
That,
I mean,
and then how you can change?
Right. So one of the, I'm a feminist, right? I really believe in equality. And yet when I sat down to take the implicit association test that measures, it's called the gender career, I showed a moderate association for women and family and men and career. And that really shocked me. And I took the test 3, 4, 5 times and I get the same results. And what this is it's showing that these associations are really the thumbprint that society has on our brains. Right? That's a quote from Mazran Banaji. But it's really true. We cannot control the associations that we have. But once we're aware of them, we're able to say, okay, I know that I might have these associations. What can I do? I can slow down. When I make a snap judgment, I can slow down and think, did I make that decision for the right reasons?
Yeah. So in terms of where these biases come from, I mean, we talked a little bit about, you know, used to having to be in tribes. But I mean, today, is it just our upbringing, or it's just our experience? It's our experiences.
It's accumulation of a lot of things, and some of it is it's societal messaging, it's our media, it comes from our parents and family and friends, people around us, and so yeah, I mean, we all have it for those reasons. The hard thing is how do you mitigate it? How do you get rid of it? And I think the first step is just awareness that we have this inside of us.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that we can get rid of it, but certainly acknowledging it and using it to help make better decisions.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. Because if it's implicit, it's just part of you, right?
This is true. There are some studies that are being done that I find fascinating. One of them is with virtual reality. And what they're showing is that if you have an intimate experience, you can actually help change, perhaps only temporarily, but you can help change some of your biases. So back to the dog example, if I'm terrified of dogs and suddenly you say, Robin, I'm going out of town. I need you to take care of my dog for a week. And I have a positive bonding experience with this dog. My bias towards dogs will change. Now, perhaps only temporarily, but that experience. So positive experiences with things that are different from us, things that we might have had biases about, is a really good thing.
Okay. Again, it's being screened tomorrow, 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. It's at the Jim Santee Auditorium. You can go to parkcityfilm.org. Check out the trailer. It's free admission. We'll have a panel discussion after the film, and Robin will be there with us. So we're really excited to be bringing her and the film back to our community. We had a great turnout for Code, and we hope tomorrow night we'll have more of the same.
Okay, Robin and Katie, thanks.
Thank you.